welcome to The Golfing Mind, that podcast that you listen to once a week that discusses the game of golf in general. And where appropriate, we discuss the mental game, either from a perspective where we can learn from others or from instruction from my good self. Now, this week, I thought it would be only appropriate to discuss Scottie Scheffler, and in particular, what can we learn from Scottie Scheffler? Because it was an amazing Masters, because let's put this into perspective. He has won two of the previous three tournaments he entered, was runner-up in the third. He came in as the world number one. He came in as the universal favourite from all the betting camps. And I think that puts a wee bit of pressure on the player to be good and to do very, very well. So you don't want to find yourself with someone who's just dominating golf at the moment, dominating so many different divisions of golf, you know, fairways hit, you know, greens in regulation, sand saves, whatever it is. And then he comes along and has a bad Masters. So I wanted to look at that. Another thing I wanted to look at was the players that were really pushing him on the last day, Max Homa, Colin Morikawa, and Edberg, the incredibly talented, which I think we would learn is a generational player. I mean, just extraordinary. And one or two people said to me, oh, it was a shame that they choked, which they didn't choke. So let's be quite clear. If you watch the Masters, a choke is when you hit a rank bad shot. You know, you duck hook your driver, you block it right, you hit it heavy, you hit it thin, you hit it off the socket, the heel, the toe. You hit what's called a rank bad shot, a fluff. We saw it the week before with the wedge to the 18th. He hit a dunch. That is technically, I suppose, in the category. I always hate it. You know, I hate the word choke. I really hate it because it suggests someone is mentally weak, and they're not mentally weak. They got what I call just overload. And anybody, and I mean anybody, can get overload. And if you've never won a tournament, as was the case with the fellow the previous week, and I forgive me for forgetting his name, he had been in 143 PGA events, and this would have been his first win. So when you have a wedge to the green, suddenly he gets a bit overloaded by the experience. Scottie Scheffler, you know, and let's put this in perspective, in 2022, he won his first major, he won the Masters, and he was playing with Cameron Smith, who was just on fire with his putter. And he went and he chipped in. I think it was the third or fourth hole he chipped in, which gave him that settler and got him sort of in the right space. And what was interesting, I mean, Scottie Scheffler very openly admits in the morning of the final round of the Masters in 2022, he was in tears. He was crying with the pressure, the weight of expectation, the recognition of opportunity that may never come again in his lifetime. Now, I can't imagine how we would cope with pressure, but this notion that people go out and choke, it's not. It happened to Greg Norman at the Masters. No, he had a four-shot lead. Faldo shot a 67, I think, and he just hit some poor shots, and there were poor shots, which it comes back down to just being overloaded. You know, when people say choke, I'm always a bit like, nah. I mean, Morikawa's shot that found the water and Aberg's shot that found the water were very well-struck shots. Now, they may have been a bit too ambitious and they may have been misaligned, but they weren't choked. So just wanted to get that off my chest before we go any further. So let's take a wee look at what we might learn from Scottie Scheffler to begin with. Well, I think the first thing to recognise is the guy is just a phenomenal talent. You know, he just is a phenomenal natural talent. And you see this particularly with his footwork. You know, there's no golfer in the world that has the footwork that he has just after impact. His feet are sliding. And no one would teach that. No one would recommend it. But it works for him. And it works for him because he has a complete and utter faith in his ability to execute the shot. So he has this, let's put this in perspective. And I say this again, very few golfers are completely mechanical golfers. Now, there are some. There are some that would probably be the first to admit they're not naturally talented, but they've worked so hard at it, they've made themselves winners. And I can think of a few players that I would put into that category. I think Ian Poulter, who I'm a huge fan of, is a guy that just said, okay, I'm 17 years of age, I've got a handicap of 5, I'm going to turn professional, I'm going to work in the Ryder Cup. And he had that drive, and he had an end goal. Scottie Scheffler, I read that when he was a young boy, a young man, I mean, in his, you know, I think 10, 11 years of age, he would dress like a professional golfer, long pants and a polo shirt. So he was already emulating his heroes because he thought of himself in the same terms that they dressed. And I think that's really important. So he wasn't dressing like a kid in short pants. He was dressing like a professional golfer. So his self-image when he was a young guy would have been that of a professional golfer. And I'm not saying he was playing like a pro, obviously, but it's a very curious thing. Now, I've been to tournaments, the Open Championship, many times. And I remember 20 years ago, you would see 4 or 5 guys dressed, I mean, just dressed like Tiger Woods, with the Nike cap, the red shirt, the black pants. I mean, and I don't know, some of them were just opportunists looking to get photographs taken. But I saw one or two just followed him the whole way around. The Woods was their hero, and they were emulating Woods in the only way they could, by dressing like him. So I think for Scottie Scheffler, as a young boy, to always wear, I don't know if he always did, but wear long pants and a polo shirt to the golf club, and he was very respectfully, knew the etiquette, is a big indicator to me is how he perceived himself from a young age. And I say this time and time again, the confidence we have as young people is fundamental in shaping how we perceive ourselves. As we get older in golf, a lot of us have a self-image, which is, I'm not a good golfer. And it drives me, when I coach people with putting, first question, I say, what kind of putter are you? The answer is usually not very good. I'm rubbish. I'm crap. Ugh. Like that. And I say, no, never say that. Say I'm a good putter. We believe what we hear, and what we tell ourselves influences us in how we see ourselves. So for Scheffler, I have to think that, you know, that was a very important thing. The other thing you hear about Scheffler a great deal from people that knew him back in the day or when he was a young fellow at high school and in college was how hard he worked at the game. You know, he'd go to the practice range and he would just work. And he tells a story that on the right-hand side of the range were the members of his club would play, but on the left-hand side, the professionals could come and hit balls. And he always wanted to be able to go over to the left side. That was an ambition. So he had this work ethic. Now, there are people who have the work ethic, and there are people that will, just by statistical probability, there are people out there who, well, work harder than Scottie Scheffler, put in more hours. And when I was amongst professionals in Florida on the range, you would see people 3-4 hours a day just hitting balls, and I hope practicing with purpose is something I was, is core to the teaching I present to others, is that you must practice with purpose. Never hit a ball without an intentional target, because it's a bad habit to get into. And I would see people in the short game area, in the putting area, practice. But, you know, Tiger Woods was a dedicated, phenomenal practicer. If golf is your career, and your career, your time at the workplace or the coalface is on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So you're going to be working 20 hours a week on the course, let's say. So that means you have a minimum of 25 to 30 hours on top of that you can practice. Well, trust me, the great players, and I believe this, I've got a theory, and I call it 5-1. And for every hour they're on the course, there's 5 hours off the course, just working. And I heard stories that just seem otherworldly of Woods being up before dawn on the practice putting green outside his house in Isleworth. And people would go and play golf and come back at 11 o'clock in the morning. He was still there. I mean, maybe these are apocryphal stories, but there's no doubt at all. Scheffler, too, has got this A, a great self-image of himself as a professional. B, a work ethic which is just unbelievable. The other thing, and I think critically from a mental point of view, something that gives him a phenomenal edge. And he said it in interviews, and some people have picked up on it, and some people haven't picked up on it, but I think it's possibly the single most revealing aspect of his demeanor, which is for him, being a golfer is his job. It's not his life. So his sense of worth, his sense of self-value, his sense of achievement doesn't come from winning golf tournaments. Like, he loves to win them. Who wouldn't love to win them? But he doesn't take it home. You know, you have a bad day in the office, he doesn't take it home. If he doesn't win a tournament or if he plays badly, it's just a job, you know. So he doesn't put himself under this pressure that winning defines me. If I'm a winner, then I'm a worthy person. And I've seen this with some people I've worked with, both on and off the golf course, who are so obsessed with them winning that it defines them. I better add to this that there is nobody more competitive than Scottie Scheffler. He says he hates to lose. You know, he says, I hate to lose. So when he goes out there on the final day, all he's thinking is attack. You know, I don't think he felt he could sit back and let people fall away. He thought, I've got to keep attacking. And he did. Even on the 16th hole, when I think he had a 3-shot lead at that point, he went for the flag. You know, he could have played to the right-hand side of the green, got it there, hoped to get down in 2 putts and still know he's a couple of shots spare. But no, he attacked. He wants to win. So, but he wants to win, but not at the cost of his emotional well-being, not at the cost of his self-image. And that was reflected in the fact he was very stony-faced. People commented, he's not looking at the audience, the patrons, and he's not, you know, he's just in his own bubble, which is, you know, where you need to be. You know, when I'm on stage giving a talk to 200 or 2,000 people, you know, I may be smiling, but I am ultra-focused on the next minute, where I'm going the direction of the presentation. I'm aware of the mood in the room. I'm aware of the state of the clock, where I am in relation to where I need to be. And I think, sounds like I'm comparing myself to Scottie Scheffler. Nah, not quite. But what I am saying is that he was very, very focused on winning. He didn't go out there with the hope he was going to win. He went out there to do hit the job. And where it proved itself in a number of holes in the par 5, he could have laid up on the 15th, but he'd hit his drive into the light rough. And I think it was 235, 40 yards. So he could have easily laid up with a 9-iron or something. But he took out a 4-iron and just went for the green and landed it on the green. Now, other players who were chasing weren't able to do that. And I think that comes down to supreme confidence in your game, to know that I have the ability to hit the shot and getting, in the famous words, getting out of their own way. The other thing, too, is his ability to have a very stable home life. He's married to a wonderful girl he met at high school. You know, she's his best friend. She's a very grounding force. So he knows whatever happens in the golf course, he's going to leave it behind and go home. And I think a stable home life is important for a professional golfer, to know there's a space. When you're under the pressure they're under, it's just quite phenomenal. And you can often, I think, take that home with you and get down on yourself, or, you know, just do things that you think to yourself, why did I do that? Why did I snap at my son? Why did I have that extra martini? And again, I better qualify this by saying I don't know personally anyone that does that, but I can imagine that it happens. So another thing is his capacity to focus. You know, he's just got this super, I mean, he leads in so many categories, and it's just extraordinary. So I think if we look at those aspects of Scottie Scheffler, where we can seek to learn and adopt from them. So that's the first one I wanted to say about Scottie Scheffler at this point. But I also wanted to talk about Morikawa. I mean, Morikawa's already won 2 majors. So it's not going to be, he's not going to be intimidated by the idea of winning a major quite as much. He's got 2 in his back pocket, so there's a bit of pressure off him. And Colin Morikawa hit some of the best irons you'll ever see. But against Scheffler on that day, one of them was going to sort of, I'm not going to say crack, but one of them was going to sort of fall foul of the golf course first. And, you know, as statistics may tell you, it probably wasn't going to be Scheffler. I thought Morikawa played really well, but he went in that bunker and didn't get out. And you could just see the drive go out of him. I mean, it was bad luck to be in that drive. You then look at Åberg. Now, Åberg, for me, is a once-in-a-generational talent. I have a theory. I have lots of theories. If you've listened to this podcast long enough, I have lots of theories, but let's stick to the golf theories. And I often wonder if for someone like Åberg, playing in his first ever major, didn't, in the back of his mind, put it onto a pedestal and say, this is the single most important tournament of my life, rather than say, yeah, I'm playing good golf, it's another tournament, let's go play well. And I think he took a lot of pressure off himself. And on the final day, I better put this out there, I backed him as my long shot to win 2 weeks ago, and I had a little money that was wagered on the boy, and I didn't put an each way bet. I bet on him to win 25-1, $10 million. So I'd have become a billionaire if that bet had come off. Yep, and now I got to pay back these guys the $25 million. What was I thinking? But he was just so relaxed. I mean, whereas Morikawa had that face that I call you chewing gum, tense. You had Scotty Scheffler, head down. You had Max Homa. I love Max Homa. You had four guys there who will win majors going forward. Absolutely. Bet on them every tournament to place top seven. You will not lose money over the next 5 years. Homa played great golf, just great golf. Clutch putts, everything. But again, he had that bounce. Went into the heavy, well, not rhododendron bushes, but it went azalea bushes. But it went, he gave him an unplayable shot. And it's on such tiny things, tiny margins, that tournaments are decided. Now, before I go any further, I'd love to give a big shout out to a wonderful artisan designer from America. Just spectacular. When I was a boy playing golf, my father had leather head covers for his clubs, and they were thin, and they were, you know, they had that lovely smell. And everyone had these leather covers. And then as time went on, the manufacturers created their own covers to adjust to the larger head covers. And you don't really see leather covers. And the ones you do, they're not so well designed. But I've come across headgeargolf.com. So that's headgeargolf.com. And they make customized head covers for your driver, your 3-wood, your 5-wood. And they will last a lifetime. They look stylish, they're personal, they're fantastic. So I'll put a link in the podcast notes. But please, I'm not getting any money to do this for these guys. I just love what they do. And I think it's a 2 or 3 week turnaround. They'll put your name, a logo or something. But they're handmade by artisans. Brilliant. And they smell good too, which is never a bad thing. So what do we learn from the Masters? I think we learned that, you know, it can produce the most extraordinary drama. I mean, just the most extraordinary drama. And that's what we want, don't we? As golf fans, we want to see the best in the world going head to head. And that's what we had. You look at the leaderboard and it was a who's who of the best players in the world. And that's what great tournaments do. They really do bring out the best in the best. And there was a few disappointments. I think I believe Tiger Woods is still struggling a little bit, and I think he set himself a fantastic target of being to make the cut for the 24th consecutive time, which no one has ever done. And I think once he crossed that line, he went job done. And then I think fatigue took over, a few bad bounces, and the golf course got on top of him. But seeing him out there, it's history. You know, and I think for a young person, to see him play now will be something they'll remember for the rest of his life. I know my father went to see Ben Hogan play 1953 in Carnoustie and followed him in his practice rounds, and every round of the Open, my dad walked 4 rounds of them. And my dad used to say before he died, oh, I saw Ben Hogan play up close. I saw Ben Hogan play. I don't think people are going to say that about me. I know Nick Faldo said he wanted people to say it about him. And maybe they will. But it's, I think, in a sense, he has legacy. He's not looking to create necessarily more legacy, but I think he does want to be in the arena. He wants to be in the fight. And I think when he believes he can no longer win, he will stop playing. And I think he doesn't want to be a show pony. He doesn't want to. He doesn't want to be remembered as shooting 18 over par on the last. You know, that's not how the story ends. And I sincerely hope that's not how the story ends, and that he comes to Troon this year, and the Scots will love him, and that's great. But there were some marvellous performances out there at the Masters, and as always, it never fails to thrill. So in summary, going back to Scottie Scheffler, what can we learn from Scottie Scheffler? Well, I think one thing is focus. He's got an incredible focus. Two, he's got great confidence. Three, he practices very, very hard. Four, he sees himself as a winner. I think he has got a stable home life. So he doesn't, I'm not saying he treats golf just as a game, but I know, well, I don't know for a fact, but I've seen stories that indicate that he still belongs to the same club he belonged to when he was 10 years of age. And he still, when he's in town, will go out and play with three members, you know, have a fun game with three members. So he still has pleasure and joy in the game. And when he plays the members, the story goes, he always takes some money. So what does that tell you? Well, it tells me his will to win is absolutely 100% whenever he tees it up, and as it should be. And I know I told the story of a fellow who got, when he was 14 years of age, had lost his parents, and it was arranged for him to play with Jack Nicklaus, and Jack Nicklaus beat him, I think, 6-5. Having given him three shots aside, because the kid was a four-handicap player. And Jack arranged, invited him to play again. So the two of them played again, and Jack beat him 7-6. And didn't really say much to him during the round, but was very cordial and very kind to him after the round. And the kid sort of said, oh, you didn't say much in the golf course. And the guy goes, yeah, well, I was playing golf, and I needed to make sure I won the match. And the kid kind of looks at him, and Nicholas goes, you know, there's no way some snotty-nosed 14-year-old kid from Holland is going back to Amsterdam and telling his buddies he kicked Jack Nicklaus's butt. He said that wasn't going to happen. And that's what I think is important, your will to win. But put it in context. Don't let it make you an ass. Don't let it make you a grump. And don't let it get in the way of living a good life on the golf course and off it. So there it is for this week. But two things I'd like to say before I go, and I always say this. I have a website, seeyourgolf.com. The audiobook version of Silent Man Golf is due to be out today, but there might be a snag with the uploading at their end, so keep an eye out for that. Also, the headgeargolf.com, fantastic. So I'll give you one more time. headgeargolf.com. Look them up, have a look, get a pair of get whatever you want. I'm not on any commission, I'm not being paid, I have no discount codes. I just love their brand. They're great, really truly fantastic. Well, that's it for this week, and until we meet again, wherever you are in the world, be well, take care, and play good golf.